Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, welcome to one more edition of Politics Done Right. I'm McBurto Willis, your host. I really do appreciate you spending a couple of hours or whatever time you have to give with me today. Of course, we are here to talk. We are here to listen to the problems afflicting this great nation of ours and how we can make a difference in solving these problems. Today, the main topic is still, as usual, as always, the middle class, how to strengthen the middle class. And I came across a piece written by Senator Bernie Sanders, and it was basically, can America be Denmark? Again, the question that he asked was, can America be Denver? be Denmark. Not Denver. Denver is in America. Anyhow, I read that, that really hit a note, and I wrote a blog about it. But then I also wrote a blog, and that blog I titled, Americans Would Prefer Denmark's Social Safety Net and Tax if Informed. Then I wrote another blog called Economy Improving, Middle Class Decimated, Poor Still Suffering. And I think they all go hand in hand. So I want to get started with that so that we can really, really get into the discussion. And for everybody that wants to talk, just remember to push 1 on your telephone, and I'll see a little thing here to know that I need to get to you. I'm going to get to everybody, so hang with us. I want to make it an interesting and informative show. We want to make sure that we inform each other, and we also have some sort of what are we going to do? Because on this show, we don't want to just talk about problems. Don't you really get tired of just hearing problems? Don't you want to be a solution to the problem? Don't you want to have a real, real grassroots movement that's going to force all these politicians from Obama right back to Boehner to do what we want them to do, not what they have the corporatocracy have them do, but what they want to do. So without further ado, but beforehand, I better give you the number to call in. The number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. Please be sure to give us a call, and I'll get you on air. We'll talk. You tell us what you want to talk about, but let's get busy. I'm going to go ahead and start with the blog I wrote for the Denmark issue. Americans would prefer Denmark society safety net and taxes if informed. Here it goes. Last year, Denmark was ranked the happiest country in the world. This year, Denmark is ranked the second happiest country in the world, topped only by Norway. They are both successful, high-tax, very good social safety net, universal healthcare, unemployment compensation, retraining free or affordable high education countries. They are both democratic. Denmark and other Scandinavian countries weathered the 2008 Great Depression better than most of Europe and the United States. They did this even with what Americans would consider a bloated public sector. Many will argue that these countries are small in comparison to the U.S., and as such, it is not a good comparison. Many will argue that the wealth from North Sea oil reserves is partly the reason. Many will argue that because these countries are strong welfare states, that they are less competitive. The reality is Americans have been lied to or allowed to wallow in their own ignorance. They have been taught to believe fallacies that counter one's intuition. Once this indoctrination is complete, change towards progress is non-existent are painfully slow. And if one is to believe in the economy of scale, America's size makes efficiency even more possible than in these small countries. And I'm going to stop the vlog here because I want to interpret that one sentence. The first thing people would come to you about when you say, oh, we could be like Denmark or Sweden that have better social services, better safety, social nets, social safety nets. They say, oh, but those are small countries. The U.S. is too big. But at the same time, we say, let's put these companies together, because in putting these companies together, we can be more efficient. Let's put all these services together, because if we put these services together, we are more efficient. It's called the efficiency of scales, right? The economy of scales. If you can do a whole lot of the same thing, it's easier, quicker, better. Yet, that's what America wants us to disregard. They want us to disregard what they've taught us, what economists have taught us. But let's continue this vlog. America is extremely rich with natural resources, not only oil. The problem is that it is distributed unfairly among the few that stole it or bought it on the cheap. As an example, 25 families own 1% of all land and the resources of that land in America. Think about that. Assuming that were the case, how many own America? Continuing. Denmark and other Scandinavian countries with strong social safety nets have not made them less competitive. In fact, and remember, we only deal with facts here. In fact, they are way at the top of the list with the United States. We're talking about competitiveness, folks. So in other words, that great safety net has not turned their people into loafers. But you know, in America, we use all kinds of distractions, racial distractions, sexist distractions, and all these things have put people against each other so that we can think one person is trying to get over the other. We try to divide and conquer. But continuing the blog again, most other countries at the top have strong social safety nets as well. As a society, they care more for the social, economic, and health well-being of their fellow citizens than America. And that is fact, folks. The evidence is there for you all to see. One of the reasons Denmark and other Scandinavian countries with strong social safety nets weathered the Great Recession better is that they had built-in stimulus. In America, when one loses a job, they get unemployment for a short time. This recession was an exception, of course. We kind of extended it because this was really a depression. But going forward, that unemployment is much less than wages and runs out quickly. That means the contribution to the economy by that laid-off worker makes a recession much worse, as much less money is entered into the economy. In countries with strong safety nets, workers get up to 90% of their wages. As such, the economic shock from unemployment is mitigated till the economy's overstock condition is mitigated until increased employment is required. That's basic economics 101, folks. In America, we are encouraged to disregard logic and obvious reality for the sake of ideology. The ideology is present to maintain not only a status quo, but a country where only a select few will ever have the opportunity to be wealthy. It is me first. That's selfish ideology. It is an ideology where wealth is built on the backs of the middle class and the poor. What is it, folks? It is nothing more than class warfare. But whereas many accuse those that speak like I am speaking now, like many are speaking, of trying to induce class warfare against the rich, no, folks. It has been class warfare for a long, long time. The only problem is those with the guns and the bazookas and everything have been those that have been pilfering the middle class. I don't say that lightly. It's all in the numbers. and it cannot be refuted. Period. It cannot be refuted. I will urge you to read that blog that I wrote there, because I also have embedded within that blog the senator of Vermont, Bernie Sanders, letter that he wrote after going around with the Danish ambassador to a whole bunch of fanfare around Vermont. So take a look at that letter. And folks, I'm going to be heading to the phones in a little bit, but I really want to get this other blog out as well, because this is going to be important to the discussion as well. The number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. Come on, folks, give me a call, and we'll talk about this. Those that are on hold right now, I'll be with you shortly. This blog shouldn't take me too long. The other blog title, Economy Improving. You know, that's what the president said this week. I named out all the good things that are happening in the economy, but you know what? A whole lot of middle-class folks are not seeing that. A lot of the poor are not seeing that. Because it is okay to say the average. If we say the average wage in the United States is $70,000, but one person makes $100 million and everybody else makes a few thousand dollars, the average is high. But guess what? The distribution is poor. Continuing. Economy improving. Middle class decimated. Poor still suffering. According to the conference board, consumer confidence is at a five-year high. It is now sitting at 76.2. The baseline is calling it 100 in 1985, up from 69 in April. Wow, that's a big jump in 1 month. More people believe the job market will get better. Their upbeat outlook also applies to their short-term expectations for the economy. According to the New York Times, housing prices rose in every one of 20 cities, tracked continuing a trend that began 3 months ago. Similar strength has appeared in new and existing home sales and in building permits, as rising home prices are encouraging construction firms to accelerate building. Wow. It was not too long ago that high gas prices had consumer sentiment fallen. Now gasoline prices have fallen and seemingly stabilized. The stock market is at or near an all-time high. All this seemingly good news is making everyone feel as if a real recovery is on. All this euphoria about this recovery must be taken with a grain of salt. One should remember the phrase, you never let a serious crisis go to waste. The American plutocracy abetted by the government sure did not. The Great Recession was used to its full potential. Austerity during a recession with large deficits became the policy advocated by the now debunked right-wing economists Reinhardt and Rogoff, and adopted by much of Europe and to a lesser extent in America, even as a renowned Nobel Prize-winning economist advocated otherwise. Government laid off thousands of paid employees, even as they hired low-wage contract labor. The Fed continues to keep interest rates very low. States continue to slash spending on education and other middle-class programs. What does all this mean? It means middle-class pilfering version 3.0 in process. It is a fact that the wealthy's wealth is growing at a faster rate than the economy at large. It is a mathematical certainty that only by extracting growth from the middle class can this process continue. That is exactly what current policies are allowing. A smaller government that pays contractors in lieu of employees that earn a living wage and benefits is a transfer of wealth to the few who make a profit on the backs of the low-wage workers. Low interest rates mean those that were dependent on already small interest payments from their savings must live on much less. Banks, however, can borrow at these extraordinarily low rates as they lend and at relatively high rates. Folks, that's an important point. There was a time your grandmother, she saved a lot of money. She earned that little 5% on her money in her passbook and so forth, and she could live on some of that interest. That's non-existent. You throw your money in the bank and you get 0.0001% interest. A little. So, you know, and this is all policy. Policy, pilfering what the middle class does, while the upper classes that runs the banks and so forth can do as you please, can continue to lend at higher rates while they pay nothing in passbook savings. As government cut budgets, tuitions continue to rise. Students are then burdened by more student loans, and with that, a slowdown in their upward mobility. With housing prices on the rebound after being depressed for so long, one can expect the vultures to come back in vogue. And you know who those vultures are, folks? The banks selling government-backed reverse mortgages are primed and ready to take much of your equity as they entice you to live la vida loca on your equity instead of leaving your nest egg for the next generation. The economy is on the mend. The middle class is unlikely to come back to their relative level of income and wealth. The winds are simply too strong. The unions are too weak to advocate for enough middle class folks. There is a large enough unemployment pool to keep wages low. Indebted graduates must take whatever they can find. The danger of an improving economy is that Americans have been down for so long that they accept this new floor for the middle class. Americans allowed their pilfering with the high-tech bubble and the housing bubble. These were nothing but a form of middle-class wealth donation to the wealthy. If Americans allow another recovery on the backs of the middle class, indentured servitude will be next. Americans must fight for systemic change. Free higher education must be the norm for the poor and the middle class. U.S. must incentivize keeping jobs in the U.S. through the tax code. Much higher taxes on the wealthy to rebalance what was taken through purchased political policies are a must. And with that, I will get to the phones. I have several calls ready to go, but beforehand, I want to remind all my dear listeners, 646-929-2495. I would love for you to engage on this. This is an important topic, and this is something we've got to do, folks. We have really have to start not only engaging by listening here on the radio, by playing a little bit of Facebook, by getting mad, and we have to actually engage. That's what we have to do. And 954, you're the first caller up, and all you guys that have pushed one that are waiting, the area code 954-513-908-917, you will all be gotten to, so please stick with me. 954, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
It's Neil. How you doing?
Hey, Neil, talk to me, my brother.
Well, you know, it is systemic. I mean, the one thing I've noticed that Obama has been doing, and it's going to be very interesting, is that he nominated three people to the federal court at the same time. If the Republicans do their usual obstruction the same way they have filibustered over 60 job bills, then basically at that point the Senate is going to use a nuclear option and with
right.
50 votes to get these judges in, because the Republicans are controlling the agenda through the back door by stopping all the judicial nominations. But the major problem is that we can't get these Republicans out because they're so gerrymandered that the American people can't get these people out, and that's the real major problem.
You're absolutely right, sir.
And the real issue is they're not interested in jobs. They're not interested in infrastructure anyway, jobs. They're not interested in education. They want to charge students 10% because they want to create, like you said, a class of massive indentured servitude, of just really just giving up psychologically and just accepting that America is going backward compared to other countries. We don't have bullet trains. We have Amtrak. We don't have health care like other countries. They're trying to create a dystopic world in this country that is ruled by this theocratic plutocracy that is basically everything that's opposite of patriotism and the teachings of Christ.
Look, man, you are so right about that. But what we have to do, Neil, is we somehow have to get over look, these guys have experts. They have foundations that know the buttons to push in people so that they react negatively to what you've just stated. So we have to find a way. It's all about marketing. Sometimes I get into trouble at some of the organizations that I work with, Move to Amend, and even sometimes Coffee Party, where I talk about marketing. And I'm no marketing expert. I'm learning as we go. I talk to a lot of people with the attempt of seeing what buttons need to be pushed so that people can understand. Because most people, when they really, it happens almost like a switch. When they say, oh my God, I see it now. I really see it now. And it's, what does it take to do that? And that's what we have to work on. When I continue to say things like, we need to stop just talking here alone. But when we're talking here, part of our discussion needs to be, okay, what, when we get off this station, or when we get off this call, or when we, or finish reading this blog, or finish reading something that let's say David Cobb or one of these other guys that put these information out there done, what are we going to do next? And that is what one of the things that I want to make this radio show about more often than not. And that is, okay, Neil, this is what we're going to do. We're setting this up. We have a lot of people here at Coffee Party working with that will be working with the 535 product when we have it funded appropriately, likely run by some of our own members like Frank and others, to actually work on this. So these are things that we will be doing. So stay with me and let me get another call, and I'll be right back with you, my friend. 513, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Oh, you know who 513 is.
This sounds like Laura.
You betcha, babe.
Go for it, Laura. Talk
number
to me.
One, does everybody know that there's more than one type of average?
Say that again?
There's more than one type of average. There's more than
yes.
one way to calculate an average.
Well, you know, here's the deal. There's really, let me get the technical term here. There's only one way to do an average, but people play games with the way they compute averages. In other words, if we take salaries...
Well, right, but that kind of does make a difference, and people need
yes.
to realize that.
Right, you're
there's
correct,
the mean,
Laura.
There's the median, there's weighted averages, and I think there's one I forgot the name of.
Exactly. Now, when you just talk averages, it's taking the aggregate and dividing by the units. That's an average, period. Now, when you talk about other type of averages, weighted averages, you'll say like, oh, well, because we're only taking this part of the population, we give it a bigger weight than the rest. That's not a pure average, but they've named it weighted average. Now, the mean says, or rather the median says, what half the population or half the units are over that number and half are under that number. The median is a better representation of the health of the wage structure in the country than averages, because averages would take what Bill Gates make compared to what, you know, my garbage person make or something like that, and that would make a good average, but it would be a terrible distribution.
Yes, but see, there's no law that says I can't call that an average and not tell you what type of average it is.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's no law that tells you just about anything about that, so they can write about anything and put anything out, right?
Exactly, and that's always my point, is that we have to beware that the devil can always be in the details that are not revealed.
Exactly. You have that right, Laura. You have that right. What else you want to tell me, my friend?
The only other thing I want to tell you is, how can you be happy living in a country where we're at verbal warfare with each other all the time?
Well, you know, I verbal warfare is not what we want, but we do want a lot of verbosity, right? We want people to be talking and what's going to be better and all that.
Here we're always at verbal warfare. I mean, listen to the mean-spirited things that are said on television all the time. I mean, those mean-spirited things are said to me when I take a bus ride sometime. We're not having class warfare in Denmark, and people are well taken care of, and everybody does their best, then, of course, they would be happier than we are. Being angry doesn't make anybody
right.
happy.
But
you ever heard
what...
an angry, complaining person sound happy?
No, ma'am. And here's the deal. They want that, though. Our plutocracy, it strives on keeping people. Listen to Wolf Blitzer, a nice guy, but everything that Wolf says sounds like it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what is, you know, you listen to CNN has become a moderate, a mini Fox News. MSNBC is a screaming machine. I mean, it is by design that if we are screaming at each other, right? We are not really.
Do people really enjoy being that miserable?
Well, no, they don't. But you know, I don't. I'm not a psychologist, right? But I have a feeling because I'm going to tell you this. I can only say it from a personal point of view now, or personally.
Okay.
I have been teaching myself, and it has been successful in different environments. You could call me the nastiest name, whatever you want to call me, and I have so non-internalized verbosity right now that
mm-hmm.
all it does is makes me hold back and then ask questions or engage, you know? And again, it has begun to serve me well. In other words, I don't, even if internally the first reaction is a sting from what somebody says, because
uh-huh.
my first reaction is trained to not react, I then get a chance to pause and move on from there. So that has been working so far, but it is something that I think we have to
work on.
Yes, it's something that you have to work on, and everybody's not going to do that. So because everybody's not going to do that, oh yes, you're going to get a screaming match. Now, what I do think, however, is, and I think have seen this worked as well, and I'm pretty sure it'll work with just about anybody, because it's not really my idea, it's what I've learned from other people, and that is, if I'm going into a dialogue, let's say on Facebook or any other place where there's ranting or whatever, and let's say I decided to engage somebody that's really acting crazy and using profanities and calling me the most vile names, and you know what some of those names would be, I would always respond back without addressing the name calling or whatever, but simply addressing the specific that the person is concerned about. And I've seen many people, when you do that, immediately or after a few posts, stop getting wild, and then finally becoming one of your allies. And it was funny because I had an incident that happened when I brought up this Denmark thing that was just that way. This guy wanted to tear me apart, but at the end of the conversation,
behavior,
I think I agree with you.
Devising it, it's strange, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes, ma'am. Exactly.
No.
But, Laura, stay with me. Let me get to 908, and then I'm going to rotate back. Folks, the telephone number is 646-929-2495. You can engage me on Twitter as well, Egberto Willis, at Egberto Willis on Twitter. I'm going to be looking at the Twitter feed. I just brought that up. And likewise, you can go into the chat room for the Blog Talk Radio and drop a line. But you know what I prefer, folks. I like to talk to you guys personally. We enjoy the discourse. So don't be afraid. Give me a call. 646-929-2495-908. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, John from Jersey. How you been?
Hey, John from Jersey. Talk to me.
Well, the one thing is, you know, the whole economy is getting better, and we can see it, and we got to stop with the, you know, like the rhetoric that comes from the other side, because the proof is in the pudding, you know? But
yes,
the
sir.
Big thing that I thought was interesting was, you know, their whole attack is the Obamacare ACA, and this is the thing that they've been pretty effective of doing, and I have to agree with it. You know, I heard the commentary, and I tell you, I have to agree with it. They want to attach something else and then say the word Obamacare scandal too, okay? So it's like Benghazi, Obamacare, IRS, Obamacare, something else, Obamacare, okay? It's all about the one thing, and it's so true that they got to keep up. NRA, going after your guns, Obamacare, you know what I mean?
You know, that is so funny, isn't it?
It is, but you know, it does work for them pretty well, because the thing, and it's sad, it really is sad, even though we've heard the news, Obamacare is doing phenomenal, which now they've got to be angry about this. They've got to cause a distraction. So, and these are the distractions. These are the distractions. But the one thing they are successful with, okay, because I even hear it from people who are like, oh, God. And I heard yesterday from somebody about, oh, God, you know, this Obamacare thing's going to be coming, you know, what the heck, and this and that. They are successful because there are about 53% of Americans who are still weary of it, as was back in the day with other programs, you know.
Right.
Now that, of course, they would never see the desire for these other programs to be gone, you know. But they are successful, as is, and it should be pointed out very well, to stop attaching something else and then saying Obamacare.
Well, you know, that is something that I think they just about have to do. You know what is so scary? I don't really think that these guys hate Obamacare at all. I think because, well, you know, technically speaking,
I disagree
right,
with you.
John,
they do and they don't.
Let me tell you what I mean, though, and then tell me what you think. First of all, I think a lefty like me should hate Obamacare much more than anyone on the far right, much more than any moderate Republican, much more than any blue dog Democrat, and I'll tell you why. I think in as much as I support Obamacare because that's all we could get passed, comparing that social safety net with Denmark or all the other countries that have these tight social safety nets, it is a beer. It really is. In other words, having to do things like setting up separate exchanges in different states and setting these all these different things that you have to create a marketplace to reduce costs, it's a big lie. In other words, yes, cost is going to be reduced because, yes, there's going to be some competition, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to realize, and we have to sometime in this country realize that profit in certain domains is an inefficiency. And, okay, all you capitalists scream, but I'm going to say it again. Profit in certain domains, like healthcare delivery, is an inefficiency. And let me tell you what I'm talking about. We are creating all these structures. We are going to create 50 exchanges minimum in 50 different states. All of them are going to have heads and bureaucracy to run them in 50 different states. Their sole purpose is to pay a bill. Okay? In other words, their sole purpose is to collect insurance from all of Americans in 50 different ways to pay for their health care. It's not like my heart attack is different than a heart attack of somebody in Pennsylvania. It's not. So in this case, there is no incentive for us to have had 50 marketplace, and within each marketplace, several insurance companies that are bidding for your monies. Because
but you say that it's not different state to state, but it is, because anything is different state to state. I mean, we're not talking a federal total Medicare program here. You know, we're never going to go from the privatized thing to a Medicare, you know, or like a European type system. I know that you and a lot of other people, even on Facebook or wherever it is, they think that this is going to happen, but it's never going to happen because the lobbying in this country is too strong. So it's never going to happen.
Okay, can I ask you something, John? Let me ask you this. If it could happen, would you be in favor of it?
Not truthfully, no. I mentioned that to you before. Because
I forgot.
I think,
so could you tell me why?
Well, I think we're on the right track. I really do. I think I mentioned to you before what they hate and what they love about Obamacare. The insurance companies included, okay? What the insurance companies love about Obamacare is the 20% that are not on the rolls, okay?
Right.
They're going to get 20% on the rolls, and that's a lot of money, okay?
Yes, it is.
What they hate is being told what to do. They hate the pricing competition. This is a country of capitalism, and somebody put it well. If we like capitalism in this country, then how the heck can these companies, you know, hate what Obamacare is going to do, basically, is create and foster a forced capitalism back into the system.
Wow.
And
you know,
how can they hate that? But they
no,
do.
You see?
Because they,
you
they're
see?
Looking. Yeah.
You just agreed with me. Remember how I just started? I said, technically speaking, Obamacare is something a lefty like me should hate, and those on the right and far right should love, because it follows. You are so right. It follows that exact model. We capitalize everything. You see, I am a free market guy. Free market within America. Free. Everybody has a chance to compete. All of that. But I'm also for a very, very strong social safety net. So
yeah,
many people want to call me a socialist. I don't care, but that's what I'm for.
But, Alberto, the thing
yes,
is, we have a capitalist system. It can't just go to what you want. It can't happen.
I agree.
Not at all. And it won't happen, I don't think, ever in this country, because we don't have the mentality to go to a socialist almost anything, okay? Except roads and stuff like that. You know, we just don't have it, okay?
Now, I agree with you, John. I agree with you. And in fact, that's the reason why, you know, like I said, I am for, I don't know if any, for folks, I first, let me announce, I always try to get my book, little niblet out there. I have a book called, As I See It, Class Warfare, The Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom. Go to my website and check it out. And the reason why is, I believe in a strong social safety net, but I also explain where I think the free market works and where it shouldn't be, where it's not the free markets, where capitalism can work and where it shouldn't
right.
be used. And
but
I try to make
I got
that
your,
distinction.
I have your point on that it would be great that everybody has socialized medicine because of the fact that we get taken care of, and then there's a sort of a lessening of the cost overall, and in some senses, and that how people think of it. Okay, but
mm-hmm.
I went to a gastroenterologist's office recently, and I went to some other offices for like a sonar kind of thing. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You have to understand that, like, we in this country at one time we had all these kinds of services in hospitals only. Okay, now we've got these companies, individual companies, all over the country, even in these technical offices. Okay. So they got doctors who are set up all here and there and this and that. They're not going to surrender to a very socialized, almost a communistic system that you're actually talking about. There is no way. They're not going to surrender to where they're going to be totally dictated upon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Plus, otherwise, we are talking. That is true communism almost. That is
no,
true
no.
Communism.
Okay. Let me make a distinction, because I think I hope. Nobody gets that. You see, a lot of the conflation between people like to conflate communism and having a social and socialism. The reality is, America already is a socialist state, just not to the degree that Denmark is.
That's true. But what
okay,
you're asking
now,
for and you're talking about is a surrendering of their practices.
No, not really. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. No. And you can see I actually laid it out in the book. First of all, there is a reason for profit. Profit has a good aspect to it. I'm a businessman myself. I make a profit from selling my software and my products. I strongly believe in everybody being able to take their craft and live
okay.
by the profits of their
so,
craft.
So,
so
what's
that's
the system
what
that you're talking? What's the system that you're referring to, though?
Let me. Yeah, that's why I was talking about what I actually laid it out in the book, and it goes as follows: there is a reason for profit because it garners innovation. Okay. In other words, if you want a business to be successful and come out with new products and so forth, there has to be a profit mentality for most Americans, not all. There are a group of what I call, I don't remember what I call them, but that believe no matter what, they want to produce. And they're not doing it for the profit motive, but there are a whole lot of people that do. That said, that's the material.
Mm-hmm.
What's
but,
important
but,
here is that I believe, let me finish.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there are certain parts of life. It's a moral responsibility for certain parts of our economy to be not profit-based. What part of the economy am I talking about? As an example, healthcare. The mere fact that, when I say healthcare, I'm not talking about doctors' portion, I'm talking about paying for health care. Insurance companies, and I've stated this clearly, up to 30% pre-Obamacare was simply going into the pockets of investors and the high-priced people who run it, period. That's what it was done. In other words, we were using capitalism to take health care insurance as a product. And because we treated health care insurance as a product, it meant making a profit on that product. And as you already know, making a profit on something means that you maximize profits by reducing what you put out. And that's what was done with healthcare, which is inherently healthcare insurance, which is inherently immoral. Why is it
now,
immoral?
Let me ask,
yes, sir, go ahead.
Let me ask you, Teddy Roosevelt in 1912, in the third time that he ran for president, Teddy, not Franklin, Teddy in 1912, who tried to run as an independent, desired universal health care. Of course, it got shot down. And no one really ever talked about really true universal health care ever since as a definite, because we wouldn't have a sitting president that could sign off on it, okay? So Teddy Roosevelt was not given a third time in office, that's for sure. Okay, so, and we've even shot down what Hillary tried to do, which is pretty much really ACA Obamacare, okay, basically, you know?
It was
and
a lot more complicated, though.
Well, but my thing is, what do you disagree with the ACA itself? I think it is a pretty good thing that fosters together a sort of socialized system additionally with what we already have, yes, Medicare and Medicaid. So it additionally links that with the capitalistic system of these individual hospitals and offices, doctors' offices, and private insurance companies,
entities, right, laboratories, and so forth. Yeah.
What's that?
Okay. You know, I hope you first understand before anybody gets any kind of questions about my support. First of all, I am a pragmatist, and not only a pragmatist, but I believe in compromising. And that's the reason I support Obamacare. Okay,
if considering what you're desiring, okay, which I don't think will ever happen, the only way that you can go through that bridge is through ACA. This is the only way.
And you know what, John, you're absolutely right, and that is one of the reasons I support it. I honestly think that the hooks are in HCA. It's really there in HCA that at some time we will have Medicare for all. And let me tell you what I mean by that. And this has nothing to do with getting rid of private doctors or all that kind of stuff, which I think is almost a necessity. But the reality is a lot of the things that I am asking for is mostly what I call humane issues. We should have a system where there is a baseline. Everybody gets care. You want psychedelic care. You want real great first-class care where you're getting a room with flowers that's changed every day, single room or whatever, pay for it. That's fine. Buy insurance
but
companies.
But ACA is out to do that. ACA is out to do this. And what it's out to do is it's out to put people who are and can't pay for insurance, who need to pay for insurance, which they're going to – look, the government knows everything about you, me, and everything, okay? They know everything about us, okay? So when it comes to how much money you're bringing in, except if you got a cash job, okay? So therefore, the people who got cash jobs, yeah, they can get away from such. But the thing is, which everybody mostly has, is they've got a paycheck, which they know. They're basically going to say, you can afford insurance. You're going to have to pay for this, okay? Because we know you can afford it. We know cost of living in the state. We know cost of living here. We know how much it's going to cost in total, general, this and that. So you can pay this in this area, in this part of the state, in this part of the country. And same thing. You know, it's like if you fall below, they know. So somehow you are going to get into some sort of Medicare or Medicaid kind of thing. There is going to be that. That's what they're discussing, that they know. Here's these people who fall way below the belt. They're going to get some sort of care, and it's going to come at zero cost, right? Well, everybody who's got insurance now, they're riding the system the way it is. You still stay with your company, you know, have it as what it is. The big thing was back then with the Republicans was they wanted to create a mandatory system, okay? Bob Dole and all them talked about it, a mandatory system. The thing that they wanted to do was push the pendulum. They wanted to push the pendulum of cost from the way it is, which is still high for employers regardless. They wanted to push it way more, okay? It's high for employees, it's high for employers because it's all just high. They wanted to push the cost away from employers, just like they don't want to pay wages to employees. You know what I mean?
I hear you. Okay, let me tell you.
Hold on one second,
John. Let me encourage other people to call in because we have a lot of calls here, but only three of you that have your hands raised up. Folks, the number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. Give us a call and add to the discussion. What do you think about what John is saying, what Laura said, what Neil said? Let me ask Neil, have you been listening to John at all? And give me some of your thoughts, Neil, if you're still around.
I believe in Medicare for all. I really think that we need a single payer system. It's just basically the greed of healthcare. That's the real thing. I mean, that's what's stopping with everything else. I mean, everything is about profit. It's not about the people. It's not about getting things done. It's about maintaining massive amounts of profit and off people being sick. They want people to be sick. They want to. If you ever look at all the commercials of pharmaceuticals, every single pharmaceutical, there are more side effects than the actual disease. That's not done by accident. That's done by design. Then you get sick. You need another pill for that side effect, and so on and so on, and it funnels the trillion-dollar industry. That's what it's all about.
You know what is so funny, Neil? My wife has lupus, right? And she takes a little cheap pill called prednisone. It's a steroid, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That pill, because she takes that pill, she takes an expensive stomach medicine to make sure that pill doesn't burn her stomach. She takes another pill to make sure that pill doesn't just keep her up from sleeping. I mean, she takes a whole lot of other pills just because she's taking that one prednisone
steroid. My mother, God rest her soul,
took
17 pills.
Wow.
One pill to basically survive with another pill. And it really, that's why I don't really trust, I don't trust a lot of the medical doctors. They basically get kickbacks. They want you to try this medicine. Hey, try this one. And it's almost like candy, but very, very expensive candy. And it causes addiction. I mean, I mean, there'll be a pharmaceutical to help you sleep. The side effect is sleeplessness.
Right.
Then you take something else. I mean, I laugh. I just think it's
Go
ridiculous.
Go ahead, Neil.
Huh?
You're so right. I mean, the thing about it is, whenever I see John, I'm gonna put your thing on hold for a while because I'm hearing a lot of noise. But Neil, it's interesting because whenever I see one of those drug commercials on, right, I cringe because it's not that. It is that. Why do you want to encourage the user, the uninformed user, to go into their doctor's office and say, hey, I have dancing feet. Can you cure that for me? I think there's this stuff called, there's even a thing called...
Restless leg syndrome.
Restless leg syndrome. My God. Are you for real? I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I mean, my leg gets restless sometimes, I guess. John, I'm going to come back to you. I hear you. And it is just amazing. But going back to the Medicare for all, what I really hope that John would have understood from what I'm saying is that my beef is not with those private practices. In fact, there are a lot of good things that I can see right here around Kingwood from Obamacare. Kelsey Siebel, which is a very complete medical doctor. I went to have my colonoscopy there just a couple of months ago. And they were so perfectly set up now. They are proud to announce here in Texas that they were the first group to actually get certification under Obamacare for being perfectly inclusive. In other words, all the doctors know what the other doctor is doing. So when I go into that office and I spoke to one doctor initially and then went to the other one had all the records together, pulled it up. He knew what the other guy diagnosed. It was wonderful to see that in action. There are a lot of people complaining about Obamacare. John, I am for Obamacare. The portion I don't like is a lot of the hoops that we're going through, and these hoops were simply to allow insurance companies to remain in existence. And whereas we could have had one entity, hell, we could have formed that. We could have had insurance companies. We could have had one insurance. We want competition. We could have had one insurance company bid for the services to pay a bill, rather than having the complication of still having all these different entities. You know, like I said before, a heart attack is a heart attack. You can come back in, Duran.
Yeah,
I thought you cycled.
Yeah, no problem. Let's see. Okay, I'm just going to give you something and then come back into it. You know, Mayor Bloomberg with this thing with the soda and all that kind of thing. You know, I think he knows, it's unconstitutional, but he makes a valid point. He makes a valid point because it really affects the cost of our health. And you know, he knows he's going to get shot down. But he's trying to make a point. And part of our cost compared to other countries' cost is the way we live. And it's our health. The medical field in this country, medical is at fault too, but they don't mind making us sick and unhealthy so that they can start treating us to make money off of us, you know? And this is a crazy capitalist system, and we've bought into it. You know, okay, you know, drinking soda or drinking this and drinking it, you know, oh, you know, drinking fried chicken and this. I mean, eating fried chicken and eating, you know, fish that's at McDonald's and stuff like that. You know, that's the worst thing on the menu at McDonald's, actually, is the deep fried fish. So the thing is, and of course, people think fish is healthy. We're causing our own demise as far as the cost. You know, and I guess, you know, with the ACA, they're trying to bring us back on the track, and I'm sure that there will be something down the road which will help for keeping us healthy as a preventative, you know?
Yeah, sure, actually, believe it or not, some of that is in there, but I'm getting some noise, but I want to make a few statements because I want to kind of get back to Denver. I mean, not Denver. Why am I calling Denmark Denver? Denmark. Laura, did you just laugh at me, Laura?
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, well, what can I say? Sometimes I get tongue twisted or twisted tongue or whatever you call that. But anyway.
You're
look.
Not alone. It happens to everybody.
Denver is a beautiful city in Denmark.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay, here's the deal. These guys, I mean, like I asked folks to read the Bernie Frank letter that he wrote. You know, I mean, I think the concept, you know, a lot of people complain about how would the concept work? Would it really make Americans lazy, or what would it do? I honestly don't think so. I mean, think about this. If you are, I'm going to have to put some mics on mute for a little while. Think about this. Because it happened to me. I was kind of lucky when I formed my company because my wife was working for a company, and once I decided to go solo, I could jump onto her insurance, you know. So that wasn't – I had a product I wanted to develop, and absent my wife working at this job that I could get the insurance until, you know, I could actually afford to get my own with the profits from this business, I would have been in deep trouble. So for all those people that continuously talk about if we become a country that provide all these social services, that we are going to make people lazy, I think they're wrong. And I actually think, like I read in the blog that I wrote, because after reading the Bernie Sanders piece, I went and did some research because it had concerned me that some people actually believed that these countries somehow, because they were so, they provided such a safety net that they were inefficient or no longer competitive. And when I researched that, I realized that all these countries are at the top. They're innovative and they produce stuff. They are looking into the future. The people don't get lazy. I think laziness comes from education, not being educated. Now, what I think in America we are producing is by having a mass of people that are getting substandard education, sometimes going to the social safety net does, you know, you don't have any pride, you don't have any whatever. I don't mean pride. What I meant is any upward mobility. That was the wrong word. If you lost your sense of upward mobility, then of course. But if you're in a place where if you really want an education, and I'm going to be honest with you, I talk to a lot of young people. And I don't know, there are very few that I have ever spoken to that just want to go out there and do nothing. Every young person that I speak to, I stay at Starbucks a whole lot and I see a whole lot of young folks. I try to engage them every so often. They want to do something. But before I open back up the mics, I want to look at something that I had in the blog here that I read. Because if you noticed, in the blog post for this show, I had there's a piece written in the New York Times by Thomas B. Edsall. It was called Why Can't America Be Sweden? Vis-a-vis my paper was, or my thing, or was previously, Why Can't We Be Denver? Well, this guy said, Why Can't We Be Sweden? And what was so scary in this particular paper was how this professor from MIT came out. His name is Darren Acemoglu or something like that. And he had a statement that I want to read to you because it was amazing. He said the following. We cannot all be like the Nordics being the people on, you know, in that area, Denmark, Norway, or I don't know if Denmark, Nordic, I know Norway and Sweden, but anyway, we cannot all be like the Nordics, Acemoglu declares in a 2012 paper, and the name of his paper was called Choosing Your Own Capitalism in a Globalized World, written with his colleagues James A. Robinson, a professor of government at Harvard, and Thierry Verdier, a scientific director of the Paris School of Economics. If the cutthroat leader, the United States, were to switch to cuddly capitalism, that's how he puts it, cuddly capitalism, this would reduce the growth rate of the entire world economy, the authors argue, by slowing the pace of innovation. Of course, Denmark proves that wrong. And I'll tell you how he came up with that. But anyway, Acemoglu, Robinson, and Vernier put their argument technically, but there is no mistaking the implications. And here is what they said. We consider a canonical dynamic model, and notice how these economists like to use these big words when they're going to tell you crap. We consider a canonical dynamic model of endogenous technological change at the world level with three basic features. Huh? Anyway, let me continue before I go off. First, there is technological interdependence across countries, with technological innovations by the most technologically advanced countries contributing to the world technology frontier, on which in turn other countries can build to innovate and grow. Second, we consider that effort in innovative activities require incentives which come as a result of differential rewards to this effort. Huh? I understand all of that, but I mean, he didn't have to put it that way. As a consequence, a greater gap in income between successful and unsuccessful entrepreneurs increases entrepreneurial effort that thus a country's contribution to world technology frontier. Finally, we assume that in each country, the reward structure and the extent of social protection shaping work and innovation incentives are determined by forward-looking national social planners. I'll be honest with you folks, these guys are nuts. It has to be a plant from the plutocracy or payment from the plutocracy that allows these guys to write something like this. But I have two callers before I go and explain any more of that or talk about why I think that was a crazy paper. Let me bring in 816. 816, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, Egberto, this is Jay.
Hey, Dr. Theis, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I actually want to hear you explain that first.
Did you get it, man?
Well, Well, I mean, I'm familiar with Robinson and Acemoglu. They wrote a book called Why Nations Fail that I actually liked.
Okay, here's what he says. We consider a canonical dynamic model of endogenous technology change at the world level with three basic features. What's the first feature? There is technological interdependence across countries. Okay, we know that. You didn't have to say it that way. Then it says, the world, by the most technologically advanced countries contributing to the world frontier. Here's a mistake I see in that, first of all. He first wants to take claim that this great capitalist country, our country, America, is the frontier of high technological output. He fails to tell you that a lot of our technology came from, let's say, one, immigrants coming into the country and being successful at what they do at, let's say, universities, etc. He forgets to tell you that a lot of technological advances have actually occurred in other countries that then we capitalize. So that statement, as far as why we have to be cutthroat as we continue to be, is really nonsensical. Then he says, second, we consider that the effort in innovative activities require incentives which come as a result of differential reward in efforts. In other words, Jay, if somehow what I'm doing is I make a hell of a lot more money and more profits than you do.
Which we know is true.
Yeah, but guess what? Is that really what creates innovation? Let me give a perfect example that I actually gave in my book. Drug companies make a ton of money. True? They've created a lot of drugs, but where did a lot of the pre-planning, pre-invention from those drugs come from? Government grants. We the people provide tax dollars for research. Secondly, when these guys garnered patents from products that were developed partially or mostly by government or public dollars, they patent these guys. After the patent expires, and I'm going to give you the classic example I gave in the book, Claritin was a popular drug, reduces the fizzles and the sneezes from allergies. When that drug expired, what did they do? Did they use that differential to be more innovative? No. The differential wasn't used for that. They created another product called Clarinex. And what was Clarinex? Just another product that was invented long ago attached to Claritin. And they patented that. And that created even more profits. So that blows a hole in anybody who tells me that these profit differentials are somehow inherently within a capitalist society going to be used for better or more innovative actions. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I largely do, and I'd need to look at that study. In their book, they were arguing about extractive industries, and I got the perception they sort of felt like the United States is basically in extractive industries, extracting wealth. In other words, the plutocracy makes its money by extracting the wealth of the country.
I agree with that.
And so I'd have to look at their study. I think there's another angle on that that's problematic. One of those is why is economic growth the be-all and end-all? I mean, we've seen what economic growth has done to our planet over the last 100 years. So that may not be necessarily the most important goal for an economy or for a society.
You know, Doc, I think that is probably the most important thing said thus far. Why is our measurement of economic success or the well-being of the country economic growth? I don't know. Can you tell me why you think so?
Well, it's been defined that way because it fits the interests of people with power.
Now, I mean, that I'm going to have to agree with because, you know, every time we look and say, you watch the CNBC and you hear about the only thing these guys talk about is growth. How are we going to do this? We're going to grow ourselves out of it. You know, there's a mathematical problem. You remember earlier today we were out there doing Move to Men. Dr. Theis is leading the Move to Men here in Kingwood. After we were speaking about the economic, how the economy works, and you know what? I just lost my train of thought. Why did you interrupt me like that? I'm kidding.
Well, I'm sorry about that. But look, first of all, and there's another point I want to make about that, which is that, well, let me go back. Economic growth as we measure it is not necessarily always a good thing. If we burn down all our houses and rebuild them, we'll have huge economic growth. But are we any better off?
True.
You know, our GDP will show a big increase because we rebuilt all our houses, but we're really not collectively any better off. And I think there's a whole variety of ways in which, as a society, we're not better off, even though our economy shows that it's growing. Great example is women go out into the workforce, men decide they don't want to stay home with the kids, so we build a big daycare industry. That it contributes to GDP, but is our society better off because now we have more people working, more people dealing with the stress, and kids being raised by third parties? I don't think so. So I think we got to look at the issue of economic growth as the goal. I think there's other goals also which have to do with quality of life. The other thing is, I tend to agree that there needs to be differentials in rewards to spur innovation. But the question is how much? How big do those differentials have to be? I spent a lot of time in school doing my PhD, in part because I liked it, in part because I knew I would earn more money than if I just had a master's or just had a bachelor's. And it would provide me with certain other benefits, like flexible schedule, et cetera. So I don't think that a person needs to be able to earn $50 million a year to have the incentive to innovate. I think earning $1 million a year instead of $30,000 is ample incentive. And in places like Denmark, Sweden, Finland, or Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Norway I'm most familiar with, they still have wealthy people. It's a matter of degrees of wealth. And I think that's something Americans really need to think of. In the end, it's not whether we need to be like Denmark, but can we live in a prosperous society where we are happier and achieve results that Denmark seems to achieve?
Couldn't have said it any better. Now the question to you, how do we get there? How do we help? Because it's not in the plutocracy's interest, that whole prose that you just gave, it's not in the plutocracy's interest. I have ideas as far as how we have to do this. What are your ideas as far as what you're going to tell these listeners that they need to start doing as soon as they get off listening to this show?
Well, I think we have to advocate for policies that put people ahead of profits. I mean, look, the reality is unemployment is good for a capitalist system. A capitalist system wants high unemployment. In Denmark, they made a conscious decision that they're going to work for full employment. We could do that here. We could create something like the Works Projects Administration or the Civilian Conservation Corps that gave people that wanted to work human potential that is being wasted and lost because they are unemployed and idle, the ability to work and contribute to society in beneficial ways, whether that's building highways, creating pathways and parks, nature trails, working in schools, et cetera. There's all sorts of jobs that need to be done. And work so that, and try to create a set of policies that everybody that wants to work can work. And if the capitalist system doesn't hire them, government will give them jobs that contribute to the long-term wealth of this society. I mean, everybody makes it out like government creating a jobs program is make work. The Hoover Dam was not make work. The Hoover Dam was built with the WPA, and we're still enjoying the fruits of that investment. Most of our national parks, trail systems were built that we're still using because of the CCC in the 1930s. So I think there's productive, beneficial ways we can invest in American workers and provide them jobs that will benefit our country for the next 50 or 100 years even.
You know, Doc, that statement you give and that whole group of what we can do, I smell a book out of that one. You know, that's a good book right there. In other words, how do we start to tell Americans, how do we try to enlighten Americans that government jobs, as long as you're not competing, let's say, even with the private sector. In other words, you know, a few shows ago I said, I had this blog that I said, if the private sector won't hire, let the government hire. Then I got all these emails, the government doesn't create jobs. Well, actually they do. But, you know, I mean, the way you expressed it there was so perfect.
Well, and another thing people have to think about is, was there ever a time in America where it was a better society, where things were fairer, where people were less stressed, where the plutocracy wasn't in as much control, where people felt the chance to work hard and make them improve themselves, where we were more like Denmark? Well, I would posit there was. And largely it was a period of time when we had very high marginal tax rates on the wealthiest individuals. And when we had high marginal tax rates in the 1940s, 1950s, into the 1960s on the wealthiest individuals, had a much smaller percentage of pre-tax income. A lot of people don't want to tax the wealthy because they don't want the government to take somebody's money. I don't want the government to take somebody's money either. But what you'll find is if you have a high marginal tax rate on the wealthy don't pay themselves as much. And with all that extra money, they invest in new machinery. They pay their workers better, so they have more loyal employees. We could go back to that very easily, but nobody's making that argument.
But you know what else, Sam, that really kind of bugs me? I like when folks talk about the wealthy and how they got their wealth or whatever. I don't know if you remember the discussion we've had on worth. In other words, we've decided to apply certain types of worth to people that I don't know it's really warranted. As an example, you're a professor, you know many teachers and so forth, that they move our knowledge as a country, they move our knowledge on just about everything that relates to the country going forward. They are the ones that move knowledge forward. No ifs, no buts. That's a contribution to society that cannot be argued. Somebody sitting behind a terminal moving a stock, making orders of magnitude over people that do that kind of job. That is still problematic to me, that I think is an intrinsic wrong in the country, but it's way above my pay grade as far as how is something like that solved. I don't know if you can tell me.
Well, and I agree with you, Egberto, and we've had this discussion before. The problem is we've decided to let the market determine worth. And the market has flaws. Economists are pretty much in agreement on the types of conditions that need to exist for a market to function properly. So, for instance, you need to have, and they make these as assumptions, you need to have perfect information. You need to have competition. Well, education is something that it's very difficult to get information as to what is a good product and what is a bad product. If I do my job as a teacher well, I get students to think about issues. That's hard to measure. One of the movements we've been doing in education, which I think much to the detriment of education, is to try and measure exactly what students are learning, and you get the teaching to the test. Thinking is not something you can measure very well, but the stock market you can measure really well. How many dollars a person manages to make a day or a year through manipulations in the stock market. That's easy to measure. The things that are easy to measure get high rewards. Things that are hard to measure, which is why, because they're hard to measure, one of the reasons that the public has taken over much of that function, don't get very big rewards. I mean, how do you know if I'm a good teacher? I mean, if I do a good job teaching my students, the evidence of that won't be visible for years down the road, usually. And it's not just my teaching, it's a combination of all the teachers that particular student has had, along with all sorts of environmental factors, of parents, etc. So it's hard to disaggregate all those causal influences as to why a person is successful. And that actually fits nicely with the healthcare debate, because I don't think healthcare is amenable to market solutions. And I know you like ACA because that's what we could do. I don't think it's going to solve our problem. It may bring costs down a little bit, but I think largely a lot of people, they're not going to buy health insurance because they can't afford it, and the little bit of subsidies aren't going to change that, which means the system basically stays intact. Healthcare is a perfect example of something that needs to be a public good because there's limited competition, and there's imperfect information. I mean, if I get in a car wreck and I'm laying on Highway 59, I'm not calling around to different ambulance companies to see how much they're going to charge me to take me to the hospital, let alone calling different hospitals and asking them how much they're going to charge me to set my broken leg. You know, it'd be like if I went into a used car lot and said, oh, I like that red car, send me the bill. Well, of course they're going to overcharge you. And that's one reason I think healthcare has to be a public good that's paid for through taxation. Which brings us full circle to your earlier conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. I agree with that wholeheartedly. The problem is that we have to somehow convince Americans that is, you know, they've had indoctrinative issues for so long, it's going to be extremely hard to convince. And you heard the discussion that I had with John from my friend John from Jersey, that we spoke about that, and you know, oh, I thought he had just recycled. I was going to bring him in, but hold on a second, Doc. Let me bring in 620 and see if he has something to add. 620, who do I have the honor of being with?
This is Jack Golden again.
Hey, Jack Golden, talk to me.
Yeah, well, I get more disgusted every with the. Just the Republicans saying no, 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 Tea Party types, obstructing obstructing. And I may have a different mix of comments with this 818. That used to be my area code, California.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
even? Right.
Yeah. I lived in Van Nuys and San Fernando Valley for 39 years. And what I'd like to do is good example, health care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that can be a public good, yes. I don't know, everything can be marketable, measured. Everything is statistics. There are statisticians and there are liars. It used to be that was the old joke I had way back when I was in college. I'm 82 years old. Be 82 years old tomorrow, as a matter of fact.
Well, happy birthday, sir.
Yeah. And thing to do, I can solve this mess in a minute. It's very simple. just
solve
take
it for
out
me, Jack.
The tax code. Reform.
Okay.
Okay. You can reduce the 70,000 odd pages of tax information down to 100, maybe no more than that. People don't want to do it. Politicians are more worried about being, I think I had a discussion the last time, about being reelected than they are about doing their jobs to curb two-person legislation to save the nation. And I believe with this guy that he should go back to Roosevelt, FDR, with the CCC and the WPA and the PWA and creating jobs that they can do high volume railroad work.
Not only that, I think one of the things Dr. Tice was specifying as well is that when the government decides to hire, it's not just hiring for the sake of hiring. And he gave the example of the dam that was the Hoover Dam that is still providing rewards.
Yeah.
And you could probably name a whole lot, the TVA and a whole lot of other government created jobs that are still given value right now, Jack. So I think that's what Dr. Seitz was actually trying to allude at. But stay with me, Jack. I want to bring in Laura again. She cycled, and then we'll come back around. Laura, you had something to add?
Yeah. There's one thing I don't think you guys know. Until you're in the system, you don't realize what the system can be like.
Okay.
I don't trust the government to tell me how much of a subsidy I need in order to be able to afford other things. When I had two kids, and I hadn't worked in several years, and I finally got a job that was definitely not paying me enough to support my kids, and I had a soon-to-be ex-husband in a psychiatric ward so that I couldn't get any kind of support out of him, what they thought I needed as far as on a sliding scale wouldn't allow me to buy my kids' lunch at school, buy them clothes, and people said, well, buy them at a resale shop. I said, there's no guarantee that I can go to a resale shop and I'll find clothes that fit them.
Laura, I want to engage you in one area and work with me on this side, because this is a conversation that I've been having with a whole lot of people when they said government doesn't know what I need, or government is no good, or government is XYZ. And so work with me here. My contention is the following, okay?
Uh-huh.
You believe, you just made the statement, government doesn't know what you need. First of all, I can understand where that statement comes from. The second thing about it is, let me ask you one question first. Yeah, let me ask you one question, though. Government doesn't know what you need. However, my question to you is, who does?
Me.
Good. You know what you need. Next question is, who do you think is there to provide that when you are in hard times?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay, this is where I'm coming from. The people who have disdain for the government because the government is low performing, right? My answer to them, to you as well, is that we don't dog the government, or we don't say government is bad, or we don't necessarily say government doesn't know what I need, because the reality is ultimately we need to make sure that government is really what it has always supposed to be, we the people. So when, Laura, government doesn't know what you need, it is then time for us to find a coalition to make sure that we the people know what it is that under conditions that occur to humans in our country in that manner, that isn't how it works, and we need to make government work. My problem is, a lot of people on the right, and I know that's not you because we've spoken several times before, but a lot of people on the right, they use the screw-ups of government to then say we don't want government and make the assumption that somehow some other entity can do it better. And my contention is, it's not the other entity that's going to do it better. It is an engaged population that is really we the people, that actually get it done. And I'm not, this is not anything against free enterprise and all of that, which I'm in 100% support for. What I'm 100% against are for those who look at government as some foreign entity trying to provide, tell you what to do. We have to, the only way government can be this foreign entity that's not doing what we think it's supposed to do is if we remain unengaged and we give that plutocracy that supremacy over we the people. And I think that's what we've done for too long. And one of the reasons that I get involved with what we're doing here with the radio show and with all the other things that we all do together is that eventually we have to take command. We have to take responsibility for making sure government reacts, not letting a few people use government as a scapegoat to take away our freedoms. You get what I'm trying to say, Laura?
Well, let me give you a couple quick examples, okay, Egberto? Then I think it'll make it clear to anybody who's never had to be on the system.
Okay.
Okay? In this state, the only way you can possibly get Medicaid is if you are a minor child under the age of 18, if you are pregnant, or if you are 65 and older, and one other, and this is how I got it, legally mm-hmm. declared disabled.
Right.
So if you are not disabled or in those other categories, I don't care how poor you are, tough luck.
And that's wrong. I think that's wrong. But my contention to you then, Laura, is that is where we have to, you know, when people say take back our country, or and in my case, I like to take back our government. We want to have a reactive government, a proactive government that actually is going to not just be buried in a bureaucracy where, you know, you, as you explained there, in other words, how can they not see that a family cannot be sustained in that condition that you mentioned? But we have to be engaged to solve that.
Believe it or not, I have worse to tell you.
Okay, let me hear worse.
When you are qualified for Medicaid, every bit of money that you have over $600 a month must be paid for your medical expenses before they will kick any money in. So you cannot have one penny more than $600 a month.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I think we have some draconian laws, you know, that actually force people to do things that they shouldn't do because the society is not Let me ask you one quick question. If during your time of pain, you could have gone and done something, I'd gotten a job that paid the right kind of wage, you wouldn't just want to sit down at home and do nothing. Am I correct?
I'm sorry, say the question again.
If you had the wherewithal to go to work, I'll put it shorter. If you had the wherewithal to go to work, you would,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah, rather than try to live off of less than $600 a month, of course.
And that's my point. My contention is, yes, there are people who would abuse the system, but that most people do not want to. But, Laura, let me bring 908 in. I think 908 wants to come in. 908, is this you again, John? John, is this you again?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought.
It's me.
Okay, come on in, John.
Well, I heard, you know, what you, of course, you originally started off with the blog about, you know, and I've actually seen a story similar to yours about America being Denmark, and I think you're, you know, what you state is great because then it makes us think, that's for sure, okay? I think your other friend there was right on target that we're not Denmark, so it's not going to happen that way, but we could still think about it regardless. Anyhow, the one thing he's right about, very right about, is that, well, I mean, he sort of made a misstatement in essence, but he's right. You know, the high unemployment or sort of sufficient unemployment in the country helps companies out because then they can pay lower wages is what has been happening recently, and they've been glad about this. Walmart and companies are ecstatic about this. You know, there is a point where, of course, what's good for corporations is bad for the country.
But also,
absolutely,
too much unemployment is bad for corporations too, because then nobody's buying their products. So, you know, they have to. There has to be a balance there. You know, the norm of unemployment used to be between like 3.5% to 6.5%, which hopefully we get back down to, because that's good for the health of the country. You know, I mean, there has to be some unemployment. Otherwise, yeah, there's, you know, there has to be turnover. You know, you're never going to get to zero. You know, but I'll tell you one thing. I like to go back into with ACA. This is a big thing, which people sort of forget about it, you know, with Obamacare, ACA. And I'll go on two quick points. But the thing is, we brought in a lot of farmers into this country over the 70s and 80s, late 70s, early 80s, 90s and kind of stuff, okay? We brought them in, and these owners of the farms, okay, they don't pay them any medical, okay? Now we're talking about bringing with this big thing, Rubio and on the Democratic side and everything, and talking about immigration reform, okay? And with ACA coupled and this and that, there's a big complexity there. And of course, the corporations or especially the pharma lobbyists are definitely worried about this, okay? So of course they're going to go after attack Obamacare, okay? They're not paying medical, okay, for these farmers, for illegals or, you know, or illegals to be
undocumented,
legal.
Undocumented, sir, undocumented, undocumented.
No, or undocumented, I mean, you know, but the thing is, the thing that comes into play, it's a major issue that people are overlooking here, because, you know, later, some of these people, even though, you know, let's say their children will be actual Americans because they were born here, and will actually be working on the farms because they don't have money, they're poor. They could be working on the farms with their families there. But the thing is, if they get health coverage, there's a big thing there, you know?
Right.
It's a big cost factor.
Yeah, look, I honestly think, I mean, you know, there are a lot of issues here. And when Dr. Theis talks about, is growth really all that we should be using as metrics? I add a little bit more to its growth. Is increase in profits the only metrics we should be looking at? I mean, I don't think so. Quality of life. Why don't you come back in, Doc?
One thing. Can I? One more. Last one.
And okay, go ahead, Diane. And then I'd like Dr. Theis to respond. Go ahead.
Yeah. The last thing I'd like to say is that with the medical and all that is I was trying to remember it, but.
Well,
yeah,
I'm going to give you some time to close out because we're going to be closing out in about 15 minutes, and you know I always ask you for your closing statement. So, Dr. Theis, you want to come in and make some comments?
Well, I think John's right in that there's this interplay between having to sell your product and needing cheap labor. I think corporate America tolerates much higher rates of unemployment today because there's all the international markets that they can sell their goods to. But I think he's right that there is that relationship. You don't want 100% unemployment because nobody will buy it. Nobody will be able to buy your products.
Right.
John did bring up an interesting point that I think is worth mentioning.
917, I'm coming to you next. Go ahead, Doc.
Undocumented immigration is part and parcel of an American problem that we've had since the founding of the country, and that is a search for cheap labor, whether it was through slavery, through bondsmen, bonded labor, massive waves of immigration, or today the undocumented workers. And it's always that search for cheap labor has always come with an additional side issue, which is the issue of race or ethnicity, which has been used to pit working class Americans against each other. And I think that's another issue that makes us different from Denmark. It's not an issue that we can't overcome, but we've got to keep in mind that it's working class whites, working class blacks, working class Latinos that end up fighting for the scraps that the plutocracy throws them.
I love that statement. I love that statement.
Oh, Egberto?
Yes, sir.
I do remember what I wanted to say, and I'd like the your buddy to comment on it too. Well, the one thing that I do see as a problem with ACA is, okay, with car insurance and that kind of thing, even state, federal, I don't care. If you're going to drive a car, you have to have it. You have to have it. Otherwise, the government is going to jail you, and they're going to jail you rightfully so. And there is an issue with ACA, which I think I don't know how they're going to fully address it. And then you've got the Ron Paul kind of and Rand Paul kind of thing about, you're telling me what to do, taking away my freedoms. Even though I agree mostly with everything here on ACA regardless, there's going to be a lot of Supreme Court arguments coming up with it because they are telling you to and forcibly telling you to have something that you could – and a lot of people do. They pay cash for – like mostly doctors and stuff like that, doctoring services. The problem, of course, is with hospitalization. But the bigger problem, I'd like to, you and the other friend of yours there to comment on it. The bigger problem for which, like, people like you and I who have insurance, okay, most of the people who even have insurance versus the ones that don't have insurance, we're the ones who are going bankrupt because of a catastrophic thing that occurs. And so it doesn't matter if you have insurance or don't have insurance. And the ACA and all this stuff has to address this, that we have to have some sort of special indemnity type of insurance that's going to take away in regards to catastrophic issues. And otherwise, people are going bankrupt over this, and there's a big
problem.
Okay,
let me just state, John, that and 917, I'm coming to you. I just wanted – John wanted Dr. Seitz to make a comment on that. I'll make a quick comment, which is – The catastrophic coverage and not being able to rescind your insurance, all of that is built in. Whether it's going to be successful depends on whether a lot of young people are going to join the program. Dr. Theis?
Well, that's why I think we need a single-payer system, is because so many people go bankrupt from catastrophic illnesses. When your goal is to make a profit, you have no interest in paying for those things.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, but
okay.
But we have the way out that there's the capitalist system here. The only thing is, how
John,
can we
John,
create something?
I know you have a lot to say, John, but I have 917 waiting. I'll definitely give you a chance to close out. Okay, my friend?
Okay.
Thank you, sir. 917, come on in.
Hi, Alberto. It's Jonathan. How are you?
Oh, Jonathan, before I even ask you to speak, am I going to see you in San Jose for Netroots?
Yes, at some point. I'm not sure for the whole thing, but I will definitely make some portion of it.
Excellent.
But I want to talk about Denmark because I actually spent a good deal of time in Denmark. And I came up with a very similar observation as what Bernie Sanders wrote about, but I experienced it firsthand through this friend of mine. At the time, I was I had a girlfriend there, and I got to know her family and her grandmother. I went to visit her grandmother in an assisted living community. I had to go to the hospital at one point when I was in Copenhagen. I got to see their medical care up close. I had doctors make house calls. The quality of life, I think the broader piece here that this touches upon is how little we have come to expect in the United States of our government, our economy, and our society. It is really the diminishment of the great society and the so-called freedom of, Donald Trump to glorify the power over another person, to fire him, in The Apprentice. This notion that, that's freedom. That's the freedom that Americans want, the freedom to say you're fired, with someone who the next day is out on the street, regardless of how long they've worked for you. We are the only country in the world that has people working at will, at will employment. They can be fired the next day because the boss decides that she doesn't like or he doesn't like the way your breath smells that day. And your kids will have to suffer and you will lose your health insurance. And so and we're the only country, as you noted, that doesn't have paid vacation, and we're the only country that doesn't have something like a single-payer insurance system for all. And we have all this stress in our economy built into our way of life and our culture. And a lot of it has to do with the false patriots trot out this freedom that we are free. And the last thing we possibly want is to inhibit the freedom of those employers who make us the greatest country on earth and the strongest economy. And of course, the big lie of it all is that there has been the largest redistribution of wealth upward in the history of any modern country in the past 30 years, and this has been paid for by the American dream, by the American people. And we now have, you know, a diminishment of expectation of what our society is, what our jobs will bring, what our college will bring. It is, you know, my friend in Denmark, her father was an accountant. He paid 60% of his taxes, of his revenue off taxes, but that, by the way, was after the mortgage deduction, the deduction for this, the deduction for that. He netted about 50%. His daughter went to college and graduate school and was supported until the age of 30 years old, okay? His mother was in, he said to me, my mother's in a nursing home, I pay zero. My kids have health care, I have health care. We worry about nothing. My children's colleges are paid for. He said, I do not mind paying, you know, 50% of my gross income to taxes because we live in a community, and I have the satisfaction of knowing that our community, our nation, takes care of our people and reflects the values that I hold dear. And, you know,
Jonathan,
how many Americans could really say that about our society and our
economy? Exactly.
Yeah.
Jonathan, and, you know, the big thing, I think one of the big fears here is that somehow that makes people lazy and less innovative. And that is one of the reasons within the blog that I wrote on top of the Bernie Sanders piece was that when you look at the reports, right, there is actually, all of this can be measured. And this was actually measured by the, what was it called, the Institute of something, I don't remember what it's called, that actually measured that, in fact, these countries do not suffer from any lack of innovation. They don't suffer from productivity. None of that is true. In fact, in the little book that I had written, I actually mentioned one sure thing, and it came to being a business person myself, and that is, and I'm going to open up your mic after I'm done here because I was getting the wind. Anyway, the other thing that I wanted to say is that personally, my business, had I not have a wife who had insurance, I would have never developed CamDRV. I would have never developed all these different software products because I would have been tied to the employer that I had. So I would not have been able to be personally innovative. So that is so true. The other thing about it, and by the way, one of these days you may see me steal that title. I don't know where you got it from. Diminish expectations from our society. Wow. That is powerful. But it is so true. You listen to everybody speak today. You can actually see within their speech that they really don't expect much. Come on back in, Jonathan, because that was great.
Okay,
I love that.
That's part of this narrative, Egberto, that I'm writing a lot and activating a lot in Sonoma County right now and in my community, where we have a campaign to restore library hours. You know, for the first time in 100 years, they cut back hours 25% for 2 years. You know, we're a relatively affluent community. For the first time, 25%, libraries, of course, serve the neediest and the seniors and the youngest among us. And this notion that the county supervisors who preside over a budget of $1.3 billion do not have any accountability or responsibility for finding $1.3 million, one-tenth of 1%, to restore those hours, even in the third year, is like people are sitting there saying, oh, well, you know, the supervisors say it's not our responsibility, it's the structural taxation system, da-da-da-da-da. And we have this diminished expectation not to have this term that I'm using now, responsive government. Government that responds to the needs of the majority of the people it governs who pay the taxes and who pay their salaries to govern us. I mean, you
Absolutely.
Look at who the Republicans in the House, who this sequestration and austerity, who that is serving, it is certainly not the people the majority of the people who are voting for them. It's the very small number of people who are writing the multi-million-dollar checks out of the Heritage Foundation and their, you know, the Crossroads America to get them to come up with all this BS that basically distorts, you know, what the public interest is. So we have sense of diminished returns, and we have a sense that we cannot hold our government responsible to be responsive to we the people because we don't have enough money.
Okay, Jonathan, I want to ask you for an answer here now, because we can talk about all these problems ad nauseum, right? I want you to tell our listeners what you are doing at the county level, because that is what the different groups that we are in are talking about. Actually, we're not necessarily just talking about working in Washington, but actually working from the precinct level to the county level to the state level. Tell our folks what you're doing and what they can do to actually start the process. It's not going to be fast, but tell them what they need to start doing here, what we as a society need to do to actually take back our government.
I am approaching each of the five county supervisors who we pay, we the people. What I'm doing is really, folks, I'm taking this term we the people seriously, and I'm taking it to heart. And I'm saying we the people are paying your $150,000 a year salary county supervisors. We the people are paying those $1.3 billion tax. And we the people do not want to hear you pass the buck and say that you can't do anything about restoring library fundings when you're spending tens of millions of dollars doing things we never asked you to do, such as escalate the war on marijuana in the county. You know, we voted 58% to legalize marijuana in Sonoma County. Our sheriff's department has increased spending on pot busts by 250%, incarcerating our neighbors and members of our community at unheard-of rates. When did we the people say that? So what we're doing is holding them accountable. I started a petition on moveon.com, has a petition site. We've got 600 names on it already. I'm doing a cover story for The Bohemian, our alternative free weekly, about what our county is doing. And I've gone into the law and gone into the budget, the county budget and the library budget, and come up with a big WTF. You know, this is incredible. And what I'm doing is I'm meeting with the supervisors, and what I'm doing, and this is something that is universal for everybody out there in Berto, and I'd love the coffee party to help spread this. I'm saying to them, you know, you don't want to vote, but the supervisors are meeting June 10th to June 20th. The meetings are.
Hey, Jonathan, the wind is kind of affecting us.
Okay, I'll go to a quieter spot. June 10th to June 20th, they're voting on a budget that goes July 1st. I'm getting out there to the public, and I'm saying, would you like your libraries open July 1st? Is this something we provide? There isn't a resounding amount of groundswell and support. And what we're doing is saying, if you do not vote this money, I found out how much money it costs. We've got a petition. We've got a phone call campaign. I'm saying, if you do not vote this money, you, Jane Doe, are voting against restoring library hours. And Jane Doe is squirming and screaming, and they're yelling at me. They're canceling meetings. They're saying, Jonathan, you have us all wrong. It's not our responsibility. And what I'm doing to get down to it, what we, the people of Sonoma County, are doing, is saying, you know what? Yes, it is. It is your responsibility. I do not elect that library supervisor. I did not create the library funding agreement in 1974. I elected you to supervise this $1.3 billion budget, and I pay you $140,000 a year to do so. And you know what? Do it. Make it happen. Figure out a way to find that money.
Folks, that's Jonathan at the county level building the necessary grassroots movement to get it done. That's a learning experience, Jonathan, and I hope there's one thing we get out of this. Laura, I hope you're listening too, because you've had problems with the government. It's about what Jonathan just did. Jonathan put a posse together, and Jonathan went out there, and he's taking over Sonoma County to ensure that they support the things that Sonoma County wants. And that's what we have to do as a society all the way around. I'd like to hear Doc's opinion about that. Dr. Theis?
Well, I think that's great. I agree with Jonathan on almost everything he said. We have a very limited conception of what freedom is here in the States. We have to broaden that. We have to realize that freedom doesn't just mean the freedom to make money, that freedom can mean the freedom to live in a safe environment, the freedom not to have to deal with the stresses, the freedom to be able to quit a job if your boss is abusive or harassing you, because you don't have to worry about daycare and child care, because that's taken care of by the society collectively. I would also say that organizing at the local level is absolutely crucial. We are the owners of our government. Laura earlier said what they do to you. I think that's the wrong way to think about government. Government is us. We need to take charge. We need to take ownership. We need to call our elected officials like they work for us, not that we work for them. And we need to make clear our desires and our intentions if they don't do the things we want. American public is way too apathetic. Instead of paying as much attention to the 49ers or the Cardinals or the latest sports team
or Dancing with the Stars,
Bieber's doing, we got to spend some time on what our political leaders are doing.
Absolutely. Hey, Jonathan, let me tell you something. What you're doing is extraordinarily inspiring to me, and I imagine to a lot of listeners on the show. So keep it up. And with this, I'm going to start going through our list to close out the show. So I'm going to start with you, Jonathan, because I know you're in an air condition. So give me a close-out statement, but I'm telling you, you're leaving me inspired with this show. Go ahead.
Thank you, Egberto, and I really appreciate you doing a show on this subject. This has to do with creating accountability moments on the people who have really shirked their responsibility and their accountability to we the public. And what I would urge everyone to do on a local level, you know, Egberto, how I started with Be Your Government and how difficult it was to create this on a top-down basis. What I've been doing the past year and what I think many of us are feeling called to do in our communities all over this country is create responsive government through our actions, just like the gentleman just said, as he was talking about that they work for us. And the other piece is see what you can do to push for an accountability and transparency moment. These guys in Sonoma County, these supervisors, they're not bad people, but they do what works for them politically. And unless they feel we are paying attention to what they're doing and not doing, I mean, they're about to enter a third year with reduced library hours in one of the wealthiest counties of the state of California for the first time in a century, and they have they are so cut off from a sense of their responsibility and their accountability that they're saying, it's not my responsibility. And we're saying, yes, it is. And that's
Jonathan,
what I think we need to do collectively. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And I hope to see you in California when I get there, buddy, at Netroots. So you take care and we'll talk, okay?
We will. Thank you.
Excellent. John from Jersey, give me your closing statement, my brother.
Sure. Yeah, hey. I wanted to ask the two of you this quickly. You both know, just like the Republicans know, that in 2014, that Obamacare ACA is law of the land. We are not going to get to the abridge of universal health care, right? So got to accept that fact. Now, in regards to the indemnity thing, how is that dealt with, okay? I mean, as a true thing, because that's what's going to be here. And then additionally, this is going to be an issue, even though the Supreme Court said it's accepted.
15 seconds, Jonathan.
Let me give this quickly. Muhammad Ali, if you've seen the movie, when he was indoctrinated or they wanted him to go and fight in Vietnam, and he said he wasn't going to, okay, and he stepped back, and, of course, the FBI arrested him, okay? But here we got people who are going to be for what you're going to be told that you have to have Obamacare. You're going to have insurance. How is the country going to deal with making sure that they have it? It is going to be an issue regardless of what the Supreme Court said.
Yes, sir. You are absolutely correct, John. Thank you very much. Laura, your closing statement?
As far as my attitude, I detest that word. That person has no idea of what I've been through, what I've done. And I'll tell you why. It's much easier to get richer people together and to talk to somebody. When you have money, people listen much more to you than when you're some poor piece of trash that's on the system. I'm sorry, but that's just the truth.
Laura, before I am compelled to respond to you and tell you this. That is why we have groups like we have here, because nobody is a piece of nothing. We are all in this thing, and that is where we use the power of many people together. So you remember, you come back and you stand strong, and you never let anybody let you feel that way, my dear. You hear me?
I'm sorry, I've been kicked around a lot, Egberto. And
don't you worry about that, lady. You are a part of our group, and you are an integral part of our group. So you remember that, and you hang your head up high. All right.
And I'm going to remember that you're my brother in Christ.
Absolutely. You take care, Laura. Jack, your closing statement.
Okay. I went to business school briefly and learned that profit maximization of profits is a thing. And for Lombardo, it's the only thing. Got to get rid of that idea. As Laura's problem, push for universal health care. And drugs.
Oh, go ahead, Jack. I'm sorry.
People buy drugs from Britain and Canada and wherever. I don't care the Republicans. You got a buck there.
I hear you, buddy.
Not ready to be elected.
Hey, Jack, I'm going to have to cut you short. I'm so sorry because we're running out of time, and I'm going to get cut off, and I want to get Dr. Seitz to give a closing comment. Thank you for calling, and, you know, come back next week. We'll be talking, okay?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Seitz, closing statement, please.
Well, I read an article about Donald Trump once. He inherited over $400 million from his father, and he's turned it into $1.2 billion, which is less than he would have earned on that $400 million if he had simply bought Treasury bills when he first inherited. So people like Laura are probably in the long term more productive in our society than Donald Trump ever will be. But our society places emphasis on having large amounts of money. And unfortunately, it's not an accident, because the people with large amounts of money know they are screwed if poor people ever realize that they are important and they are valuable and they have power. Remember, there are a lot more poor and working class people in America than there ever will be rich people. All we have to do is discover our collective strength and use it in the ways Jonathan was talking about. And this country can be a different place, and we can have a government that does what we want.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Dr. Seitz. I mean, I really, really enjoyed this show today, and I think Jonathan put the icing on the cake, because just watching, remember, we do a lot of talking here. We talk about problems, and notice how I started the show and said we wanted to actually empower people to go out there and do what needs to be done. Just listening to what Jonathan has accomplished was inspiring. Watching what we do here in Kingwood with Dr. Tice and other professors actually engaging the community and trying to do something to make folks aware of what they can do is great. That is what we're trying to do, folks. Before I go, I have to, of course, let you know about all our other shows. So please do remember, and I am trying to pull them up, and of course I don't have them in front of me right now, but remember, it's Politics Done Right on Saturdays, and you have me to deal with on Mondays. It is Don, and I'm looking that up right now to get the hours for you. And my computer is severely misbehaving. So bear with me 1 second as I get to the page. But anyhow, we're also working on our 535 project that isn't complete yet, but we are starting to get off the ground. But here we go. On Mondays at 10 p.m. Eastern, we have Press 1 for Democracy with Dan Aronson. On Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, we have The Middle Ground with Michael Charney and Eric Beiler. On Thursdays, we have Lunch with Loudon. That is at 3 p.m. Thursdays Eastern. And on Saturdays, yours truly, Politics Done Right. Thank you for spending the time with us. Thank all the folks that called in with some great ideas. These are things that we have to turn into action. Look, As somebody said before, this is not a sprint. It's a marathon. It is going to be slow and methodical. But that's how things stick. Slow and methodical. Thank you for being with me. This is Politics Done Right. I'm McBurta Willis. You have a wonderful, or you all have a wonderful Saturday. Thank you very much for listening.